Welcome to the award-winning Beverage Chronicles, the show where beer, wine, spirits, and everything in between get the spotlight. You'll hear the stories, meet the people, and discover the pours behind your favorite drinks. Here's your host, Gary Monteroso.
Thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of Beverage Chronicles. I'm your host, Gary Monteroso. We're going to have a couple of different reports for you today, including a really timely one from our wine critic, Robin Shreves. We'll be getting to her very shortly. First, however, the days and nights throughout most parts of the U.S. are getting a bit cooler, and that means we're starting to see some of those fall beers, and I have a report on that right now. You know, as summer begins to give way to cooler nights, changing leaves, and that unmistakable feeling of fall, the beer world begins one of its most anticipated seasonal traditions, and that is pumpkin beer season. For craft beer fans, pumpkin beers are more than just a seasonal novelty. They're a signal that autumn has arrived, bringing flavors like cinnamon, nutmeg, clove, ginger, allspice, roasted pumpkin, coffee, caramel, and warming malt character. And when the conversation turns to pumpkin beer, one brewery has been part of the story almost from the beginning, and that is Elysian Brewing of Seattle. Elysian helped establish the modern pumpkin beer category in 1997 with the debut of Night Owl, one of the earliest commercially brewed pumpkin beers in the United States. At a time when pumpkin beer was still a niche idea, Night Owl helped show drinkers that the flavors of the season could work beautifully in a craft beer. And now, nearly three decades later, Elysian has brewed more than 100 different pumpkin beer recipes. The brewery also created Great Pumpkin, widely recognized as the world's first imperial pumpkin ale, a bigger, stronger version of the style designed for drinkers looking for more intensity, more malt, and more autumn spice. This fall, Elysian's making it easy for fans to sample several different approaches to pumpkin beer in one package. Its pumpkin variety pack is returning nationwide in a 12-pack featuring three signature beers, Night Owl, Punkuccino, and Great Pumpkin. Each beer offers a different version of the pumpkin experience. First, there's Night Owl, Elysian's classic highly drinkable pumpkin ale. It's brewed with pumpkin puree and pumpkin juice, then conditioned with a blend of fall spices, including ginger, cinnamon, nutmeg, cloves, and allspice. It is the familiar traditional side of pumpkin beer, the kind of beer that feels right at a football tailgate, around a fire pit, or alongside a hearty fall meal. Then there's Punkuccino. That's a pumpkin ale with a coffee-inspired twist. Elysian describes it as having the attitude of a world-weary barista, and that is a fitting way to put it. Punkuccino brings together pumpkin flavor, coffee character, cinnamon, and nutmeg for something that leans into the feeling of a spiced coffee toddy. It's a good option for drinkers who enjoy coffee stouts, darker beers, or simply want something a little different from the standard pumpkin ale. And then finally, there is Great Pumpkin, the Imperial Pumpkin Ale. This is the bold one of the group. Great Pumpkin features intense pumpkin aromas along with sugar and spice, pours a deep copper color, and it's topped by a ghostly white head. It is smooth, rich, and built for those cool fall evenings when a bigger seasonal beer feels just right. The variety pack is a smart way to explore the range of pumpkin beer without having to commit to one style. You can start with the approachable spice character of Night Owl, move into the coffee-forward Punkuccino, and finish with a richer, higher-gravity Great Pumpkin. Whether you're a longtime pumpkin beer fan or someone who only reaches for those flavors once the weather turns, Elysian's Pumpkin Variety Pack offers a taste of craft beer history and three distinctly autumnal ways to raise a glass to the season. Elysian Brewing's Pumpkin Variety Pack is available nationwide now while seasonal supplies last. And I will admit, I purchased my 12-pack about a week ago and crack them open, and they are tasting delicious.
This past mid-April, unseasonably warm temperatures reaching into the 90s caused early bud break in some mid-Atlantic vineyards. Then, in the middle of the night between April 20th and 21st, an extreme frost occurred, causing historic damage, wiping out many early shoots. Headlines like "A late frost just crushed Mid-Atlantic Winery's 2026 crop" and "Cold snap devastates vineyards and orchards" sounded an alarm that may have wine drinkers curious about what they'll find this fall when they visit their favorite Mid-Atlantic wineries. Now, as harvest gets underway across the region, I'm talking with Scott Donini of Auburn Road Vineyards in Piles Grove, New Jersey, about what wine lovers can expect this fall at wineries. Hi, Scott. How are you?
Hey, Robin. I'm doing great. How are you?
I am okay. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me today. My first question is, how did April's freeze affect your specific vineyards?
So we were actually fairly lucky, relatively speaking. So we're probably looking at maybe 30 to 35% crop loss, which you would think under normal circumstances would be pretty devastating. But compared to what's happened to a decent chunk of the wineries and vineyards and up and down New Jersey and the East Coast, we're faring fairly well. So we're pretty fortunate.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Did you get secondary fruit after that first freeze? Did you get more bud break that helped mitigate some of the loss?
Yeah, that's what we were hoping for. And in some of the varieties, we've definitely seen some resilience. And, nature finds a way, right? So for some of the varieties, we've definitely seen the second fruit pop out. Yeah. So what's going to be challenging about that, though, is they're going to ripen a little bit differently than the primary fruit. So we're really trying to have to figure out how we're going to deal with that.
Okay. All right. It leads to the question, does fewer grapes in 2026 and you aren't having as few as maybe some of the other wineries are having, but overall, does that mean that in the fall of this year, there'll be less wine to sell? How does this play out over the next year?
That's a really fascinating question, because we're still kind of waiting to see, because we're not like an apple orchard or, a cherry grower or a peach grower where, the impact is immediate. For us, we kind of wait to see, what kind of fruit you get, what the nature of that fruit is, what kind of wine you can make out of it, and, how that's going to impact, what you would normally make. So certainly there'll be less volume of things, but I think what's going to happen is that we're going to, as winemakers, have to get more creative. And most of us on the East Coast, really, I think, are set up to do that. So you're not going to maybe get all of the same wine and the same volumes of those same wine. But we are going to make, great wine, but different types of wine. And what I mean by that is, instead of, making I'm sitting here in my vineyard looking at our Merlot right now, instead of making our, what we call Julia, which is a sort of more full bodied, more concentrated, Merlot, we would probably make more of, and we will make more of our Good Karma, which is a bright, lighter, fruitier, certainly, we think excellent, a style of Merlot that is reflective more of the year we had. And that's one of the things, honestly, that makes East Coast winemaking, and this is going to sound completely insane, but fun to do. but it also, I think, makes it fun to follow and fun to drink, because, it's so consistent and so, straight line when you're in California, where, every season is the same as every other season, give or take a little bit of, wildfire smoke. Here, you're really looking at vintages and you get to see, oh, well, wow, 24 was really interesting. It was different. It was, a good year, but it was it made different wine, and 25 did. And now here we are in 26, and you're going to see what 26, how it expressed itself, both in the vineyard and then ultimately in the winery. But that's pretty exciting from a winemaking point of view. And hopefully it's exciting for the consumer too.
Oh, I'm excited. And that Good Karma, I love that Good Karma. I tell people to get it all the time.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that.
So what people are going to be drinking this fall when they come to your winery isn't from this year's grapes. It's from what, you know, was made last year, the year before that. So how is this shortage that, you know, you have a little bit of a shortage, some wineries have a much bigger shortage. How does it play out over the next several years?
Yeah, that, like I say, that remains to be seen. And we have been lucky, you know, in the sense that, and not just us, but everybody has been out like looking to buy fruit from other local growers, because there were parts of the state that actually weathered the freeze fairly well, like down in Cape May, like by the ocean, those guys barely got touched. And so they have a surplus of fruit that they're offering to the other wineries to buy, which is awesome. And that's one of the great things about the industry we're in, is that we're all in this together. And so, you know, so that's going to certainly help. But you're right. You know, I'm sitting here looking at the grapes as they're hanging on the vine right now. And so, you know, we haven't even harvested them, much less made wine out of them. So the, you know, the Merlot of 2026, it was going to harvest in the fall of 26, probably be released in the fall of 27. Some of them maybe a little bit later. The whites of 26, you're not going to see until the spring of 27. And, you know, we'll have an idea of kind of how our volumes are going to be mitigated. And there's going to be impact. There's no doubt about it. But it's, you know, it's one of those things where hopefully we can buy some fruit. We're buying some Sauvignon Blanc from Cedar Vale Winery that's a little closer to the bigger part of the Delaware River. Mm-hmm. And they didn't get touched, and we've never made a Sauvignon Blanc before. And so Jules is going to take a crack at it, and we're going to, you know, give it a try and put it out there and have some fun with it and introduce it to, you know, to our audience. And so it's one of those, and we wouldn't normally have done that, but we needed something to, that's going to, supplant, let's say our Pinot Grigio, which is probably not going to be as voluminous as it has been in years past. So we're going to try to make something a little bit different and a little bit fun from grapes that are locally grown, and see what the winemaker can do with it.
Okay, great. Well, it sounds like you're going to have to get a little creative. And you mentioned Jules, who is your winemaker and your co-owner and also your wife at the winery. Yep. And I know Jules, and I know she can get really creative, so I'm not worried about what's going to be coming from your winery. Thank you so much, Scott. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and the listeners at Beverage Chronicles.
My pleasure, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Robin Shreves, and you can find more of my wine commentary and thoughts in my Drink Local Substack newsletter.
I think that was a very valuable report by Robin Shreves. The weather throughout the United States seems like over the last few years has been so strange, so unpredictable, and in many cases extremely violent. And let's face it, the weather certainly does impact on our growing seasons, which therefore translates down to the beverages we drink, as well as the foods, of course, that we eat. All right, let's close today's show by posing a question to you, and that is, according to the latest NIAA state-level estimates, now before we go on, if you're wondering what NIAA is, this is a government source for U.S. alcohol health information, research, treatment resources, and federal programs. So again, using the latest NIAA state-level estimates, which of our United States per capita consumes the most alcohol? Think that one out. Which state in our union consumes the most alcohol? Well, I'll give you the top 10. Number 10 is Florida. Number 9, Vermont. Number 8, California. 7th place is Colorado. 6th place, Montana. Number 5 is Wisconsin. Number 4, North Dakota. 3 is Nevada. 2, Delaware. And number 1, New Hampshire. Now, a little bit of added information. Washington, D.C., which is obviously not a state, would rank 3rd overall. And another bit of information to help clear this up for you. If you're wondering why New Hampshire ranked number 1, it's in part because of cross-border purchasing. You see, New Hampshire is one of a few states that has no state sales tax. So what happens is residents of neighboring states frequently cross the state lines to buy beer, wine, and spirits. So those sales-based consumption estimates can make New Hampshire appear to drink considerably more than its residents actually consume. Now, if you're going to go to the other end of the spectrum, down at the bottom, Utah would be the lowest estimated consumption among states. The national average is approximately 2.51 gallons per person, and Utah was down at 1.21 gallons. New Hampshire, by the way, was 4.20 gallons. And again, the national average was 2.51 gallons per person. And that's it for this week's episode of Beverage Chronicles. See you next time.